Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding, and I am joined in the studio by
Avery Truffleman.
And we're here to talk about something really exciting.
Yeah. I'm hosting a new podcast with Curbed and Vox Media. It's called Nice Try, and the first season is called Utopian, and it's about the perpetual search for a perfect place.
We got connected about this because I have a personal connection into utopian societies.
Yeah.
One of my family members started a utopian society called the Synergias, which is really cool. And you know what they did.
Yeah, so it's going to be actually a part of episode, episode 6 of Nice Try Utopian. It's totally crazy because I was reading stuff about your aunt and like learning all about this planned utopian community that you were telling me all about.
Yeah. I have a really wonderful, amazing aunt who lives off in Santa Fe, and they made this bold vision of researching climate change far before it was in popular consciousness, and built enormous scale institutions to do this research, which included the Biosphere 2, which is the inspiration for the Pauly Shore film Biodome.
1,000%.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Which is this, like, often I think the story about, my understanding of the mainstream story about the biosphere, it's, right, this giant greenhouse that has every biome in it trying to recreate our own biosphere. We live on Biosphere 1, that is our beautiful blue planet, and Biosphere 2 was this greenhouse space where they're going to try to figure out and study how to have healthy ecosystems. And I think, 8 people go in it and live in it for 2 years. And I think the mainstream narrative is, like, it was a failure. And one of the reasons why it was a failure was that the whole thing filled with carbon dioxide because they didn't actually take into account the greenhouse effect and actually, like, recreated climate change in their own little greenhouse and like, couldn't breathe because there was too much carbon dioxide in the ecosystem that they were creating. So I kind of know, like, that story, but I haven't learned the whole story of, like, who the people are and the characters behind this. I know at one point, like, Steve Bannon enters the story.
I mean, the story of Biosphere 2 is even crazier than I could have ever imagined. And when I went there, they didn't lip sealed. Like, they didn't say anything about it. They're just like, this is a place where some scientists went, and scientists are there now. Now it's owned by the University of Arizona, I believe.
Okay, and they do research there?
Arizona State or Arizona University. Yes, they do research there. Okay. And the fascinating thing is, like, when it was under the control of the Synergians, this group that your aunt was a part of and founded, really.
Yeah.
Like, she founded it.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. Yeah, so under their control, it was much more, it wasn't like hard science. It wasn't, they weren't proposing a hypothesis and then proving it at all. It was like a new kind of science. I think the way in the incredible book about it called Dreaming the Biosphere by Rebecca Ryder, she talks about it being more like Charles Darwin's trip to the Galapagos, like observational science rather than like hypothesis-driven science, which we now, under capitalism, cannot conceive of. You know, everything there needs to be like a telos to everything and a reason for everything to be.
Right.
And that was I think part of the reason why it was deemed a failure is because no one was ever clear in the beginning, like, what are these people even studying? They just came to observe and watch this world in a bubble. And maybe it was like kind of for space travel, kind of, you know, to build an alternative vision of what life in space could be like. Because, you know, when we think of space travel, we think of, like, meals and packets and, you know, catheters and, very sterile kind of hospital-like trappings.
Right.
And they were like, what if space travel was beautiful? That's part of it.
Huh.
But also part of it was, like, let's study the Earth. And
yeah.
Have you ever been to Biosphere 2?
No, I really want to.
Yeah. I mean, it's strange. It's kind of just, like, a science museum now. And it's not really clear happened. They don't tell the story. Biosphere 2 is owned by a man named Ed Bass.
Yes.
And Ed Bass, do you know this story?
I know that he's like the heir to a major oil fortune and was a Synergia.
Yes, he was a Synergian. He basically has this endless supply of money. And it was with his money that they expanded. And so, as we say in the podcast, they did what you would, of course, do as soon as you came into a limitless supply of money. They start with a boat, and they have a boat called the Heraclitus, and they travel all around the world.
Right.
And then they buy up property pretty much in every conceivable ecosystem and culture. So they have, I'm going to butcher these because I can't remember quite off the top of my head, but they have like a ranch in Australia, a farm in the south of France, a club in, or an art gallery in London, a performing arts center in Fort Worth, Texas, where Ed Bass was from. And they're just living out their dreams of being like sailors and ranchers and gallerists. And I think they had a bar in San Francisco, just any kind of life.
I want to go to that bar. I mean, we're in beautiful downtown Oakland, California right now, but that's just across the water.
Yeah. I think
I
that was
it.
Where.
I doubt it's around anymore. But.
Oh my God. And they make it sound so, it's just such a boomer relic. It's like, and their friends all came to this bar and ate for cheap. It's like, who lives like that anymore? It's fascinating.
Huh.
And so, they were just, like, trying on lives, any kind of life they wanted to live.
Huh.
It was crazy.
Huh.
And so the Biosphere 2 was just supposed to be another one of their projects. And this one, you know, they captured every frontier in the world, and they were looking at the next frontier, which is space. And I don't think they were expecting the amount of media attention it got, which I think is where they started to get really flustered.
Mm. You have, like, an uncertainty principle, like, watching. Like if you're trying to observe what's happening in your ecosystem, but you're being observed and conscious of all the observation of your observation, the whole thing is, I don't know, it's affecting the entire outcome of the project.
Exactly, exactly. And this idea that they had to present a public face about it was ultimately its downfall, because they were warned about the shortcomings, that there wouldn't be enough food. Like, there were people who were concerned there wouldn't be enough food.
Oh.
And John Allen, who was the head of Synergia Ranch, just, like, couldn't hear it. Like, he couldn't tolerate. It's funny. We were some friends and I were talking about how the most common phrase in California Tinder profiles is good vibes only. And just, like, everyone's really into this, like, good vibes only, like, no bad news.
Yeah.
And that was totally his jam. He was like, no bad news. We have to present a good public face about this project. And so, like, this dissent that was important to know about and to hear and to listen to, this criticism, just, like, they didn't take it into consideration and bit them in the ass. It's fascinating.
I'm super interested in hearing the larger story on Nice Try. This is episode 6 that's coming out. I'm particularly curious as to where it goes, because I feel like this is one of those stories of utopia where perhaps the failure of this utopia, or purported failure of this utopia, the community still exists, is used to say, hey, this kind of thinking can't work. And you have these people, like, very early on studying a sort of climate science. And sometimes when we knock down those idealistic visions, they can be squashed for a long time. And people will say, well, don't ever revisit it. And I think it is worth revisiting. On the rest of your show, you revisit lots of other utopias. So what's going on? What kind of other things can people get from Nice Try?
I mean, really foundational failures. And you bring up an interesting point that, like, nothing – the interesting thing about this is, like, nothing ends.
Mm.
There's no, like – think about it, right? Like, there's no success. There's no, like, and then they were successful forever.
Right.
Everything is cyclical. Everything goes through, like, failures and successes, and every instance of failure in this show is extremely nuanced and complicated. Mm. Like, in every single utopia we talk about, there are parts that worked and parts that didn't work.
Right.
And the simplest narrative is that it didn't work.
Right.
There's always something we can learn. There's something that in some way or another worked. And also it depends on what angle you're coming at. So, for example, like, the first episode is about Jamestown and the founding of America.
Right.
Did that work? Like, is that a success? Is that
yes
a failure?
And no.
Yeah, what is that? And, you know, at the time, the founding of Jamestown was a shit show. It was horrible. It was horrible. It was, like, an abject failure by any metric that the Virginia company was using.
Mm-hmm.
And then one could say that through that failure, and we explain on the show how this failure really became a part of the American foundational, how do I put this? The American foundational character.
Mm.
It was like a form of violence that was built into the way the rest of the country was then colonized.
Mm.
Is that a failure? Is that a success?
Huh.
It depends on who you ask. And the fascinating thing was I was lucky enough to speak with Irene Bedard, who is the voice of Pocahontas in the movie Pocahontas,
yeah,
which is, I think, probably the most popular telling of the Jamestown story because it's John Smith is a real person who was with the Virginia Company and was at one point the president of Jamestown. And Irene had extremely complicated feelings about playing this role and telling this kind of, like, romantic version of this story. And, you know, everyone I talked to was just like, was it a failure? Was it a success? It depends. Depends on who you ask.
Revisiting these stories feels particularly important right now when I think that most pop culture representations of the future so easily fall into dystopia. And I feel very strongly that what is needed is a like great sense of hope and direction beyond just, well, it's all falling apart.
Right.
And I think looking at past utopias gives us a great opportunity to understand where did things succeed and fail? But what are the conditions? What are the aspirations? How can we think about our own future utopias, even if in the definition of utopia, they never will exist?
Right.
I think it's in a very important frame of mind and a way of thinking. And worst thing we can do in thinking about utopia is not examining the past examples of them and just being like, we're just going to recreate everything new again, because that story seems to be cyclical as well.
Exactly, exactly. And we're never going to let go of that hope. I mean, that hope, the idea of something perfect that requires no work, we want it in our partners. We want it in our cities. We want it in our jobs. We're looking for perfection everywhere. Nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect.
Perhaps except for this series, which
smooth.
No, but I mean, it's a really great series. And where can people go and find Nice Try?
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Is there anything that people should know about Nice Try?
Nice Try is going to be 7 episodes. There are two out now and 3 probably. It comes out on this Thursday. So
okay, great.
Could be, depending on when you're listening, there could be a 3rd out now. The 3rd is about suburbia and Levittown.
Oh, cool.
And one's own personal little utopia in their backyard and who gets access to that.
Well, I'm thrilled about Nice Try. It's really fun. And I just want to say that everyone should go out and take a listen anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank you, Avery.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you for coming to Oakland.
Now here's a preview of Avery's first episode of Nice Try about the founding of Jamestown.
500 years ago, Thomas More wrote a novel about an idyllic society on an island. He called the island Utopia, which could be traced to the Greek roots utopia, meaning a good place, or utopia, meaning no place. It's a brilliant etymology, encapsulating somewhere that is perfect and does not exist. I'm Avery Trufelman, and I'm the host of Nice Try, a new podcast from Curbed and the Vox Media Podcast Network. It's stories about how people have tried to design a better world and what happens when those designs don't go according to plan. Season 1 is called Utopian, and it's about the perpetual search for the perfect place. You're about to hear a preview of Nice Try, in which we dive into the story of Jamestown, the first permanent English settlement in America. It's not the triumphant tale you might know from a certain Disney animated film. Instead, it's a story of transformative failure and a look at how the stories we tell ourselves about failure inform the way we live today. While you're listening, go subscribe to Nice Try Utopian on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. There's also a link in the episode notes to help you subscribe. This is, of course, one of the totally kick-ass songs from the 1995 Disney animated movie Pocahontas. I was 4 when it came out, but I had it on VHS and I watched it again and again. And in a lot of ways, in the popular imagination, the story of Jamestown has been equated with the story of Pocahontas.
This is Irene with my Lauren Bacall voice.
I know, people are going to hear this voice and not recognize you. It'll be kind of a fun reveal.
Yes.
This is Irene Bedard, the voice of Disney's Pocahontas.
What? What did you say?
My name is Pocahontas.
Talking to Irene, it was hard to figure out how she felt about the movie. There seemed to be a lot of mixed feelings. After all, Irene is Native American herself.
I grew up being called Pocahontas in a derogatory way.
Irene said that the movie's writers listened to her and asked for her input. But of course, the plot itself ended up oversimplified.
History, of course, is always told from the victors. And this was an easy way to kind of portray the good Indians who helped the masterful settlers who, you know, created the beautiful America that we now live in.
In the Disney telling of Pocahontas, it's framed as a love story. The strapping John Smith gets off this boat in the New World, falls in love with the native princess Pocahontas in this Romeo and Juliet kind of way, and a kind of peace is made between the English and the local Powhatan tribe. We cling to this love story, even though it's very transparently not true.
She was only 10 years old, 9 or 10, when John Smith came to the village.
In historical accounts, Pocahontas was kind of the cool neighborhood kid. She was very spunky and friendly and was always doing cartwheels, and everyone in Jamestown was happy to see her. She actually helped John Smith learn Algonquin, or a dialect of Algonquin that the Powhatan spoke. So obviously, John Smith was also a real person.
That's right. I'm not about to let you boys have all the fun.
Aside from being a studly cartoon voiced by Mel Gibson, John Smith was extremely significant historically. If you think about the story of North American history, like the Bible, then George Washington was kind of like the Abraham, and John Smith was the Adam. And here's why.
When they got their kind of marching orders to go to Virginia, all of the laws, the organization of the society, and the leaders of that society were written down and put in a box.
Kathleen Donegan is a professor of English at UC Berkeley and the author of Seasons of Misery, Catastrophe and Colonial Settlement in Early America. She says the idea was Jamestown would be run by council, the names in the box, and the council would elect a president who would govern the colony. The box was sealed, and it was only to be open when the ships reached Virginia.
Because they didn't want them to argue while they were at sea, and they didn't want any kind of arguments to erupt during the journey.
Although clearly some kind of argument erupted at some point, because in 1607, John Smith arrived in Virginia in chains.
Right, on the ship, yes, for insubordination, right?
This is Karen Cooperman. She's a historian who wrote the book on Jamestown, The Jamestown Project. She and Kathleen Donegan will be our two experts here. So, the ship arrives, and to everyone's surprise, when the men get out and they open the box, they find John Smith's name, this rowdy guy they had to lock up.
Smith was the only person named to the council who wasn't of high rank, social or military rank. And the idea that he thought he knew what should be done, I'm sure, was rankled these people.
And here's the thing that we like to imagine as so deeply American about John Smith. He was this common guy. And it turned out in time that he was a pretty decent diplomat. He learned Algonquin. He got to know the different tribes. He eventually became president of the colony.
What John Smith understood is that in this new venture, that authority was going to be made up of something different. It was going to be made up of experience. It was going to be made up of what you knew, what you could accomplish, how you could learn, who you could manipulate, that those were going to be the bases of authority, and not anything that came through bloodlines, and not anything that came through land, and not anything that came through institutions, but things that came through experience. And he was right.
In the colony, there were some fancy men of upper classes who were like, I told you, I don't work. And John Smith had none of that.
John Smith was the one who said, if you don't work, you don't eat. And that was a radical thing to say to the people who were in charge in Jamestown.
Although, eventually, even he who worked also did not eat. The Jamestown colonists were military men. They didn't have the skills to actually create a settlement. The council's first letter back to the Virginia Company in late June 1607 reads like a kid writing to their parents from summer camp, trying to sound happy, but actually having a terrible time. In that first letter, the leaders praise the land they chose and say they have a good store of wheat. But sign off, your poor friends. Eventually, those stores ran out. The work itself slowly transitioned to begging for food. Not growing it or hunting for it, begging for it. Because they never had plans to grow their own food.
They really thought that Native Americans would give them food.
Oh my God.
They thought that there's a very famous line from a historian, Edmund Morgan, who writes about this, who says, that is not what you came to Virginia for. He says, you still didn't get around to planting too much corn.
The men of Jamestown had a mix of vulnerability, starvation, and arrogance, a truly toxic combination. And these colonizers are getting hungrier and hungrier, and drought comes, and winter comes.
They're constantly sending boats, first up the James River and then up to the Potomac, constantly looking, searching, looking for food. And in one case, Captain John Smith says that as they forced this native group to give them food, and as they pulled away, they saw the women and children on the riverbank weeping because food was so short for them because of the disastrous drought.
Men are dying. 104 men landed in May of 1607. By the end of the year, only 38 were still alive. And this does not make the Virginia Company look good. They've got to save face for their many bondholders in England. There's serious investment in this endeavor from wealthy citizens and the government, and they cannot blow it. On damage control, the Virginia Company sends over more men, along with new leadership and new plans. They put all the leaders in the new plans on one ship, and then all the men on other ships. And that one ship, the one with the leadership and the rules, it gets wrecked in Bermuda. But all the other ships with all the men, they arrive in Virginia.
There are 300 new men now in Jamestown with no leadership, no laws, no provisions, nothing. Just these 300 men, which came to be known as the headless remnant, right? The head was crashed. These were the headless remnant. So here come 300 lawless, rowdy men into what is John Smith's Virginia.
Now, these scores of new men also need to be fed. And these men are restless and upset and starving and hard to control. To try to keep relative peace, John Smith tries to separate the men in various posts. One day, he visits an especially rowdy one.
John Smith gets back in his boat, goes back down the river to Jamestown, and it was during that trip down river that there was gunpowder on his lap, that a match flew into the gunpowder, and the gunpowder exploded in his lap, maiming him for life.
Oh.
At that point, he had to return to England.
So John Smith is gone. And from there, things are about to get bad. Very bad. That was just a preview. To hear the full story, subscribe to Nice Try on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.